From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Law enforcement culture and police training. How much do those two powerful factors contribute to the overall mindset officers have as they go out on patrol every day? Well, Grant is a retired police officer in California. Here's the type of training he says he went through as a cadet.
Just in the scenario training, you are basically fighting for your life. You've got, warehouse searches, and the person in the warehouse always has a gun. You've got vehicle searches. There's always a vehicle with a gun in it. There's always a person being held hostage, and there's always a gun involved.
And what impact did that have on him when he was on duty every day?
You know, the training itself really primes any new officer to always be on high alert, always be looking for a gun. And oftentimes I think it may contribute to people thinking that, guns are there when they're not, when it's a cell phone or a pager or, a fake gun, because you're looking for that. So when you see something similar, your brain tells you, oh, I found it.
Well, our guest today calls this a classic example of the danger imperative, a law enforcement mindset that views almost every aspect of the world as a threat, threats that quickly deserve responses in kind. Michael Sierra Arevalo is a sociology professor at the University of Texas at Austin. He has spent 1,000 hours in the field with police officers, doing ride-alongs, sometimes high-speed chases, on patrols, witnessing training as well. And he's researched and written about law enforcement and violence prevention for years. And he joins us today to talk about what he's found. Professor Sierra Arevalo, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
So those examples from Grant, the retired officer who spoke with us from California, how familiar do they sound?
Those examples could be from any department across the country, including the ones that I directly observed, one on the East Coast, one on the West Coast, one in the Southwest, or departments that have been observed, frankly, for as long as you've been talking about policing. Those kinds of examples run through our understanding of how police are taught to view the world now, just as much as it was part of police training when police training first began to be standardized and professionalized in the mid-20th century.
In the mid-20th century. Okay. So this phrase or the concept of the danger imperative is a concept that you named based on your observations from that 1,000 hours spent of time you spent with those three police departments. So I'd actually love first, before we sort of talk about what the consequences are, I'd love to explore a little bit more of what you actually saw, because you got to have one-on-one contact with officers in a way that almost no one really gets. So I'm just looking at the paper that you wrote about this, and I'm wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about, first, for example, you write about a situation in which you and a person you call Officer Stewart, that you arrived on a scene from a landlord-tenant dispute. First of all, tell us a little bit about that scene and what happened.
Sure. So that scene, the way that I wrote that scene was to give the sense that I was actually arriving at a scene with Officer Stewart. As I reveal in the paper, it's a training exercise through something called PRISM, which is a virtual training simulator that's very commonly used. There are more advanced versions of this kind of training simulator, but this particular version just has a projector screen. There's a computer station sort of attached to it. And you can project scenarios of various kinds onto the screen. Behind that computer screen will be usually an academy instructor, and they have the ability to manipulate the branches or the potential outcomes of that scenario. And so Sergeant Stewart on my right, I'm on the left. We've both been given these simulation pistols that fire infrared light instead of bullets or paint pellets. And we arrive on scene, and there is a landlord on the porch of a one-story house, and what appears to be the tenant who's on the ground, and they seem to be arguing about something. And like disputes in real life, you kind of just show up and there's an argument happening. You don't really know what it's about, but you need to address a situation. So Officer Stewart jumps into action and does what officers are very often trained to do, which is get people who are fighting with each other away from each other, right? Try and break this up and try to cool tempers. When he does this, the landlord, or the person who I believe to be the landlord anyways, who's on the porch, says something to the effect of, "You better deal with this guy or I'm going to," and he begins to go in the house. Now, this triggers something for Officer Stewart, who's already been through the academy. This is an in-service training, which is periodic training that officers go through as required, usually by department policy and by state law. And he's going to go and try and follow the man on the porch, because officers are trained that you don't want to lose sight of people, because they may be going to grab weapons. They may be going to grab any number of things that stand to do you or others harm. And so he says, "Sir, like, come back out here, come back out here." And eventually the man who has now gone in the house does come back out of the house, except this time he's carrying a shotgun. The man who's on the ground, who's arguing with, he immediately flees. Stewart draws his weapon and tells him, you know, "Drop the weapon, drop the weapon." The man on the porch does not immediately drop the weapon, though he also doesn't raise the weapon. And with no further commands, Officer Stewart fires, striking the man on the porch holding the shotgun twice in the chest. And then the scenario ends. The screen freezes and you can see where the red dots hit.
Now, in the scenario, you said that basically only just a couple of seconds elapse between when Officer Stewart says drop the gun or drop the weapon and when he chooses to fire. And he tells you afterwards, you asked him, what was he thinking when he made that decision? And he said that he had talked to the landlord before, the cop's presence was already known, and that because the landlord made the choice to go back into the house in this simulation and get the gun, that there was already a substantial threat just right then and there, and that he was in fear for his life, right?
Correct. And I think to paraphrase, because I don't have the paper in front of me, but he says something to the effect of, "And at that point, I would fear for my life," right? This is the kind of language that we, I think, as outsiders, we frequently point to and say that this seems to be a catch-all. But I think an important part of that particular example is that this kind of language, this sort of perception, is learned, an understanding of what justifies the use of lethal force. And to be quite clear, legally speaking, if an officer is to draw their weapon and shoot someone who has entered an interaction with a firearm, it is very unlikely that that kind of shoot is going to be found to be out of policy, much less to be illegal. The laws that we use to govern force would very, very likely find those circumstances to be more than enough to justify the use of that force. And officers understand that, as Officer Stewart does.
Well, and I think the interesting thing that I gleaned from your research is you didn't mention an example in which one of these simulations or training exercises was one where there was no weapon, right? That the quote-unquote suspect in the simulation didn't end up pointing a weapon or having a gun, that they were pointing at the officers doing the training. Mm-hmm. You quote one officer who you call in the paper Officer Patterson, and he says that every scenario is I'm looking at it here. Oh, he says, what do they teach you in academy? Everyone wants to murder you. Every scenario ends up with either a gun in the car and a guy shooting you or something sketchy going on. Did you observe any one of these trainings where there wasn't a weapon eventually?
There are definitely cases in these scenarios where the instructor can choose to, for example, there's another scenario where officers are called, and the instructor will always tell you before the scenario begins what the circumstances are. So it's sort of playing the role of dispatch, which is the office, usually offsite from a police department, that receives 911 calls, sort of distills that information, often losing a lot of really important information, and then tells officers what is allegedly happening at some location far away. So the officer behind the PRISM simulator will say, you are being called to reports of a suspicious person who might be breaking into cars in this particular example. And officers will arrive on scene, and there will be a man who does appear to be near some vehicles, maybe even looking in the window. And officers will arrive, and the man will immediately try to walk away. And he will have his hands in his pockets. Now, this, again, is another point that is emphasized in police training. You need to see hands. Hands are what can hold weapons, and by extension, hands are what can kill you. And so officers who are abiding by their training should be telling this this man to, let me see your hands, sir, please get your hands out of your pockets, or yelling at him, get your hands out of your pockets now. And different officers will approach that in different ways. They'll escalate faster or slower. There is variation there. And there are cases where the instructor can have the man pull his hands out of his pocket and there will be nothing there. And then you could argue that the correct answer there is not to shoot. But then the other branch of that scenario, which again, the instructor controls, is that the man can pull a gun out of his pocket in a split second and shoot the officer dead. And part of the point of the training and part of the point of the scenarios is to show officers that the difference between pulling your hands out of your pockets with no weapon and pulling your hands out of your pockets with a weapon is frankly a matter of chance. And you can't afford to take chances as an officer. You're not going to bet your life or the life of another officer on whether or not you have correctly intuited what is in this pocket that you can't see.
Yeah. You know, we just have barely a minute to go before we have to take another break. And I just want to briefly ask you, you quote an officer telling you that this training puts them in a particular mindset, that they're going to die on the job. How many, you interviewed almost 100 officers. How often did you hear that?
The specific words came from that one officer, but the notion that we have to prepare for the worst, that things could devolve into violence at any moment, was almost ubiquitous. I didn't meet an officer who said that they didn't think that their job was dangerous and that they might not die while on patrol.
Well, we are talking with police culture, police training, and how all that contributes to what Professor Michael Sierra Arevalo calls the danger imperative. We'll have a lot more to explore about what Professor Sierra Arevalo has observed and the consequences of that danger imperative when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Professor Michael Sierra Arevalo. He's a professor of sociology at the University of Texas at Austin. He has spent years researching on how police socialization and perceptions of danger influence officer behavior. He calls it the danger imperative, and he has researched the consequences of that. He spent almost 1,000 hours with police officers in 3 different American cities, interviewed extensively nearly 100 of them, and he's currently at work on a book about this subject, forthcoming. It'll be titled Peril on Patrol. Now, Professor Sierra Arevalo, there's one other aspect of your direct observations that I'd love to hear about, because I just, you know, I'd literally never heard about it before I read your paper, and that has to do with car stops. The officers told you that they were trained to touch the trunk of an automobile before approaching a driver during a car stop. Why were they supposed to? Why are they trained to do that?
So I can maybe set the stage for when I began thinking about this, and it was very much an observation that didn't become clear to me until seeing several car stops. And by that, I mean, at this point, like probably dozens of car stops. So I'm in my Western field site. I'd already been riding along with officers in my Eastern field site for some time. And on one of my first rides, I was out with Officer Menendez, who is a relatively new officer. In fact, he wasn't even off of what's called the probationary period, which is a period after you are, quote unquote, cut loose to patrol on your own. And I saw him stop a car. And before he got to the driver's side window, he made sure to go to the back of the car and touch down on the trunk of that vehicle. Then he goes to the driver's side window, he gets a driver's license, comes back, He runs the driver's information. There's no warrants, which is what happens in the vast majority of car stops that I observe. No warrants, no other reason to stop the person. And so the person is let go with a warning. But I had seen this behavior on the East Coast, the touching of the trunk. And so suddenly the lightning flashed. Okay, this is happening in more than one place. What's going on here? And I asked him to explain why he did that. And he said, well, that he was taught in the academy to make sure the trunk is always closed and that there isn't potentially a gunman who's waiting in that trunk to ambush an officer who approaches the car. Me being skeptical asked him, okay, I guess that makes some degree of sense. Have you ever heard of that actually happening? And he said, well, no, I don't know of a particular instance in which somebody got attacked by somebody in a trunk. And so then I pushed again and asked, okay, but you can admit that the probability on any given car stop of somebody being in a trunk with a gun is exceedingly low. And his response, I thought, was very telling, was, yeah, it's low, but that's how we're trained. We train for the worst case scenario. We don't train to stop granny. We train to expect someone to have a gun to try and hurt us. And he even admits it doesn't happen often, but it does happen. People do try and fight you.
So Well, let me ask you, you're the expert here. Do we know what the probability is at all of someone jumping out of a trunk during a car stop and firing a weapon at an officer? I mean, maybe it has happened, but in comparison to the other dangers that people face on a day-to-day basis?
Sure. So I don't think that we've estimated the likelihood of that particular lethal outcome of someone jumping out of a trunk. That said, there's some wonderful work by a legal scholar. I believe her name is Natalie Wood. I might be forgetting her first name, but she did an analysis of car stops in Florida. And her estimate is that we're talking about a felonious killing, meaning an actual murder of an officer in the course of a car stop, in approximately one in every 6.5 million car stops.
One in every 6.5 million. And yet, this seems to be, as you said, a common area of training in police academies.
It's an article of faith in policing it's Jordan Woods, as a brief aside. Is that right? Yeah. It is an article of faith that car stops are one of the most dangerous things that officers engage in. And the logic is that you never know who you're trying to stop. Which is technically true, unless, of course, you believe that officers are stopping people that they have good, reasonable suspicion to be stopping because of their belief that they might, say, have weapons or have committed a crime. But if it is indeed random, which would be a problem in and of itself, the logic goes that you don't know if they have a gun. You don't know. One officer in Elmont posed to me the hypothetical. You don't know if the person that you're stopping is coming from a murder or if they've just finished kidnapping somebody. You don't know. And so this uncertainty is core to their understanding of what makes every interaction dangerous. You simply do not know. And the potential cost is so high that they must take steps to keep themselves alive.
So, you know, training is one thing, and the reinforcement of you don't know what could happen. I mean, in a sense, to give officers the benefit of the doubt, this is a heavily armed nation. There are more guns in America than people, so it is not an illegitimate fear. And in fact, the other thing that you observed is that it seems as if in training in many police academies across the country, they link the training with actual videos from the field, right, of officers getting killed on car stops. And an infamous video from 1998 of the murder of Officer Kyle Dinkheller. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so that video is arguably the most well-known unknown video that exists in the context of law enforcement. Officers in all three field sites that I went to had heard about this video or seen it themselves, either in the academy or through their own perusing of websites like Police One or Law Enforcement Today. And every couple of years, there will be a reanalysis of this particular video. And the video is of a stop by Deputy Kyle Dinkeller, who was 22 at the time, part of the Lawrence County Sheriff's Office. And he made a traffic stop of a white Tacoma that was speeding. And the Tacoma was driven by an Andrew Brandon, who was a Vietnam veteran, who we now know at the time was suffering from PTSD and had been out of medication for a couple of days. So the traffic stop was utterly mundane in its origins. It was a very clear-cut speeding stop. Kyle Dinkeller pulls the truck over, and the driver immediately gets out of the car. There is some cultural variation on where people get out of the car and kind of wait by the vehicle, but usually officers are trained that you want to keep somebody in the car. They have much less ability to move, to potentially run, to take cover. You have a much greater tactical advantage if you keep a driver in the vehicle. So that is immediately out the window. He also has his hands in his pockets. He begins dancing in the street. He begins yelling at Deputy Dinkeller. And the entire time, Dinkeller is telling him to stop, to surrogate back, surrogate back, surrogate back. At no point does he actually grab the driver. At no point does he try to restrain them in any kind of way. And eventually the driver does get back and he goes all the way back to his truck. Deputy Dinkeller at this point is taking cover. He has drawn his weapon. And he's telling the man to stop. And what Brandon is doing in the back of his truck is loading a rifle, an M30 carbine, which is very similar to the rifle. I think it's actually the rifle that was issued to soldiers in Vietnam, the war in which Brandon fought. Brandon continues to call out to him, "Sir, put it down, put it down, put it down." Eventually, he fires one shot and he misses. And then that's when the firefight begins. And so the firefight goes on for these eternal seconds. And the video, I've never shown a video in any talk I've given because it's incredibly graphic, not because of the visuals, but because you hear Deputy Dinkeller screaming. He was eventually shot 10 times. The 10th and final round went through his eye. He was executed by Brandon, and you can hear him screaming. It's these screams that are full of terror and just raw animalistic pain. And that is the kind of video that is shown to recruits. And it's intended for a couple of reasons. One is to show them once again, no stop is routine. Any stop can escalate into violence at any moment. Right. Another common lesson is that officers must be prepared to use force. One of the takeaways from that video is that Deputy Dinkeller, he chose not to shoot sooner. He chose not to grab Brandon. He chose not to do a whole bunch of other things that arguably would have prevented Brandon from eventually getting back to his truck and loading his rifle and eventually executing the officer. And so for officers, this is me paraphrasing the work of Jonathan Rubinstein, a historian who wrote a book on the Philly Police Department back in the 70s, is that the question of force for police is not a matter of if. It's a matter of when and how much. Mm. And the Dinkeller video is dramatic evidence that you need to be ready to use lethal force. And if you're not ready, then you probably shouldn't be a police officer.
Well, so that video is used in for training in police academies in many places across the country. We actually have a bit of training video made by an organization called Line of Duty. Line of Duty uses some of the dash cam footage that you're talking about. This is a video that Line of Duty made about 20 years ago. So it does not include the actual, you're not going to hear the sound of Deputy Dinkeller's murder, but you're going to hear a little bit about how Line of Duty uses it in their training video.
Anybody that watches this tape and doesn't have problems sleeping at night, and I'm not one for that. This is probably the only thing in my career of 14 years that has kept me up at night. And that tape did it.
So that's a voice from a training video made by an organization called Line of Duty, and the person there is referencing the video of the death of Deputy Kyle Dinkeller. Now, Professor, this all brings us to one of the critical questions here that I want to have you help us understand. On the one hand, police officers, by definition, much of their job is to respond to calls when things are not going well. So they're asked to be involved in situations which already are starting off not in a positive place, if I can just put it mildly.
Sure.
And yet at the same time, according to figures that I read in your research, the actual death rate for police officers on the job has been falling over many years. So did you come away with the sense that there was a big mismatch between how primed officers, when they're trained, how primed they are to presume danger versus the actual dangers of their job?
There is, in a sense, a mismatch. An important caveat is something that my colleagues in particular are quick to point out, which is that measuring danger in policing by death specifically is a very particular way to do it. There's a lot of ways that you can get hurt without dying. And what we do know is that while policing's rate of felonious deaths, meaning being killed by another human being, are low, or at least have been falling, and the death rates as part of the profession are low compared to any number of professions like logging and construction and things of that nature. Policing has, I believe, by the most recent numbers, the second highest rate of violence on the line of duty. So this might be getting punched or shoved or kicked or wrestled with. The only profession that I think was higher was something like nursing assistants. Again, another surprisingly dangerous profession. This all gets talked about like it's the same thing in policing, which I think is where some of the mismatch happens. Policing is dangerous. There's no real way around that. There's not a lot of jobs where you're going to have to make people do things that they do not want to do and are likely to resist you physically if you try and make them. That much is true. But the reality of having to wrestle with somebody or having to grab somebody with the help of other officers or even having to do that alone is very different from talking about the world as if murder is everywhere. But I think in practice, the most salient and the boldest examples that get used to drive this point home for officers about uncertainty and danger and violence are the lethal examples, even if they are the rarest cases of violence that occur on patrol.
Well, Professor Sierra Arevalo, if you can just stand by for a moment, I'd now like to bring into the conversation Daniel Hahn. He is the chief of police for Sacramento, in Sacramento, California, and he joins us from Sacramento. Chief Hahn, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I very much appreciate you joining us, Chief, and I was wondering if I just might start with the basic question. How much of what you just heard the professor and I discuss regarding what he saw in police trainings, how much of that sounds familiar to you? Did you undergo similar exercises when you were training in police academy?
Yeah, I didn't hear your whole conversation, but some of it sounded familiar. I would probably have a different take on the meaning of a lot of it, but yes, some of it sounded familiar. We have to understand that I'm not sure where he did his studies at, but there's, you know, not all academies and not all training are exactly the same.
Okay. Well, he did his studies in three cities, one in the east, one in the west, and one in the somewhere in the Sun Belt. Professor, you don't actually identify them in your paper. Can you identify the cities now?
I can't by the strictures of my institutional review board, but suffice it to say they are large urban departments. They're all in the top 1% of departments by size. They're highly professionalized. They have their own academies. Many smaller departments will use a satellite academy, for example. These are their academies. They all have different posts or police officer standards and training boards that create the rules around that training. And they have very similar training, in, at least with regards to danger and threat.
Okay. So, Chief Hahn, let me then just turn back to you and cut to the chase here. When every day when you put on the uniform for the years that you've been an officer and have started your shift on the job, did you feel like you had a sense of that you were entering a world full of danger?
No. I mean, every situation you go in, you judge it by what's going on, and then you determine what level of danger and what your response is. So I don't, to this day, don't walk around thinking that everybody I come across or every situation I see unfold in front of me is dangerous to my is a threat to my safety.
Though it seems as if Professor Sierra Arévalo is, I mean, he's got ample research here that suggests that the way officers are trained does prime them to presume that there's greater danger in certain scenarios that they might encounter than there might actually be.
Well, it's no doubt that there are many situations where officers have been killed, where community members have been killed. So you're trained to look at each situation and make that judgment. I mean, I've been a police officer for 33 years, so I think I have pretty good experience in that.
Well, I'd actually love to hear more about that experience when we come back after a quick break. So Police Chief Daniel Hahn of Sacramento and Professor Michael Sierra Arévalo, stand by for just a moment. We're talking about what Professor Sierra Arévalo calls the danger imperative in American policing and its consequences. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the show, it will be our Friday weekly news roundtable. We'll be digging into the biggest stories of the week, including former Vice President Joe Biden's infrastructure and climate plans, the ongoing debate about how to best reopen schools, the surge of new COVID-19 cases across the country. And we want to hear what stories are most affecting you. Leave us a message at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. Today, we are talking with Michael Sierra Arévalo. He is a sociology professor at the University of Texas at Austin, and his research focuses on police socialization and perceptions of danger. He spent 1,000 hours in the field observing officers in three American cities, and he's currently at work on a book about this subject called Peril on Patrol. And we're also joined by Daniel Hahn. He is the chief of police in the city of Sacramento, California. And so, Chief Hahn, tell us more. You were talking about how in your 33 years of being an officer, your experience has been a little different from what we've been talking about. I mean, how would you say that you've approached the job or the experiences that you've had that maybe don't necessarily fall into this danger imperative mindset that the professor has been laying out?
Yeah, I think most officers are the same way in terms of we all know that the threat, there's a potential for threat, but we don't walk around in fear of that with everything we do. It's judged by the circumstances. And so, you know, in terms of like traffic stops, in the last just 2 years, we've had two different incidents where three officers were shot on traffic stops, where the person in the traffic stop immediately got out of his car and shot at our officers. So that potential is there, but you don't do every traffic stop taking action as if the driver is going to do that. You base that on their actions. And so the threat is obviously there. There's officers shot eating lunch in a diner. So yes, that possibility is there, but you don't walk around thinking every single person you come across is going to do that. It's based on what their actions are.
And then the flip side of that, in Sacramento, in that same period of time, how many people have been shot by police?
Well, the one guy that shot at the officers, he was shot by, well, both of them were shot by police after they shot at the officers.
Now, the one thing we haven't talked about in detail is how race works through all of this. And Chief Han, you're Sacramento's first Black chief of police. There's quite a bit of research and evidence that shows that there's fear and then there's racialized fear, that people just look upon Black men, for example, as inherently more dangerous. Does that happen with police officers?
Well, I think as the studies show, that everybody feels that way. So it's not just police officers, in society in general, including in the Black community, the most feared people are male Blacks. And that's because our history, our society, all the things that are pumped into our eyes, ears, brain every day, whether it's through the media, through entertainment, through the conversations we hear, through the things we see. And so to me, that's really the heart of what really ails us, that we rarely, if ever, deal with. And so if that's in society, then at some point, to some extent, it's going to be in law enforcement, because we hire people from society. And so we do have a higher responsibility to deal with it, because we have immense power. We have the power, our officers have the power to take somebody's freedom away. We have the power to take somebody's life away. And so we do have an immense responsibility to address that. And at the same time, we're not going to get to where we truly need to be unless we address it as a society, because today we're probably interviewing somebody to go to the academy, in the next academy, that's coming from society. And as officers, we're still human beings that live in society. So we put a blue uniform on for 10 hours a day, but we're in society, so those same stimuli are being pumped into our head every day. So we do a lot of, part of what we do here in our academy and in our department outside of the academy, is that is part of how we equip officers to work in our very diverse community. Their history, their experiences, where they come from might not fully equip them to work in all of our neighborhoods. So it's our responsibility, both as a department and as a community, to fully equip them the same way we do. How do we teach them to put handcuffs on? How do we teach them at the range? How do we teach them the laws? Well, we also have to have ongoing, whether it's training and experiences, how do we equip them to work in communities that they have no experience in, that they've never lived in, never visited, and those sort of things, which they will absolutely have to do in our city, because we're very diverse. And so we do a lot of programs at the academy, where they go during the academy, they go volunteer and work with kids in school and some of our inner city neighborhoods. We bring community into the academy. We bring a group called Brother to Brother that have all been in prison, and they come and tell their story to really humanize them and their story. We bring another group called City of Refuge in that works with women that are trafficked, that tell their story, how they grew up, and build relationships, and then are able to work with those organizations and many others when they get out of the academy. We do a program called Walk in My Shoes, where each recruit, after they graduate from the academy, get partnered with a community member from a neighborhood that they're not from, and they spend the day with them, and then the next month that community member goes on a ride along with the officer, and then they get together and talk about what they have learned. So, and many, many more, that we really feel that the issue in this country, not just with law enforcement, but as a society, is truly at the root of it, is the issue of race and the issue of differences. And we never deal with that. I mean, if you think about what we all learned in school, I have a master's degree, and I didn't learn it at any level, not in high school, not in college, not in graduate school. So is the issue of a lot of these issues around race and differences. I mean, I learned about slavery, but not very much. I didn't learn the real details of slavery. I never heard of Black Wall Street, never heard of Juneteenth, never heard of redlining, blockbusting, sundown towns, a lot of details about Jim Crow. And so in this country, we often believe wholeheartedly that if you just work hard, that you can achieve anything you want. So if we truly believe that, and then we come into a neighborhood and meet somebody's grandfather who doesn't have everything he wants and isn't living lavishly or anything like that, so do we think that person is lazy because we believe if all he had to do was work hard, he would be able to achieve? Well, the reality is, in our country, that's not actually true. A slave could work as hard as he could. He's not going to be able to get anywhere. In Jim Crow and in World War II, you could not buy a house. You could not go to college. You could not get a loan. So you could work as hard as you want, and that's just simply not true. So the generational wealth couldn't be created. So we never deal with those things in school. So how are we supposed to – and so it's even more pronounced in law enforcement, in the sense that we have a lot of power, so we have to address it.
Yeah, yeah. And look, your points are well taken here, because it's nothing operates in isolation, for sure. Ideally, institutions that have power, like law enforcement, ought to be the best reflection of the best parts of the society in which that they are charged with protecting. But Professor Sierra Arevalo, did you want to respond to what the chief is saying there? How do you see race factoring into all that you observed regarding the training and the practices in the law enforcement organizations that you had observed?
I think that the chief and I are in agreement that race and racism are not a thing that we can lay exclusively at the feet of policing. And as the chief mentioned, the police are the public and the public are the police. At least that's what Sir Robert Peel would have told us, the founder of the Metropolitan Police in London in 1829. And the problems that infect the broader society, it would be naive to think that those things do not occur in policing as well. So in that, we're in agreement. I think that what my research and what others' research suggests about policing is that the particular arrangement of training and policies and culture that arise from that structure are such that it might exacerbate the problems that we're dealing with when we talk about race and racism, in large part because of the power that the chief rightly says that police have. Police have tremendous discretion. They have the legal right to divest people of their liberty and of their lives under certain circumstances. And I think part of what makes this problem sticky is that you don't actually need to believe that every police officer is a dyed-in-the-wool bigot and racist that runs around and wants to hurt Black and brown people. This is not a story of monsters. This is a story of ordinary men and women in many regards. What is more important, I think, is to recognize that policing as an institution is born out of unequal power relations. It is born out of an unequal distribution of power, of resources. And in many cases, particularly in the U.S. context, that is a story about race. The chief mentioned redlining. He mentioned sundown towns. This is the uncomfortable history of U.S. policing. So even today, when you have a well-meaning officer who just wants to do right by his community and make the world a better place, participating in an institution that has arisen and has been perpetuated as one that systematically creates disparities in who is stopped, searched, arrested, and then killed by police is perpetuating the same inequalities that give rise to racism in the first place, that are both a symptom and a cause of it. Mm. This is not a problem as simple as getting better screening mechanisms to get rid of the quote-unquote real racists. I wish it was that simple, that we could just have a good enough filtering system. This is instead a story about systems. This is not a story of bad apples. It's not even really a story about bad barrels or bad trees, so to speak. This is a story about the roots of the policing orchard and what the institution was designed to do.
Right. Well, so, Chief Han, if I may ask, perhaps, say we arrived at a point where all that you want us as a society to know and recognize and be educated about, say that happened. Would that have been enough to, for example, stop the shooting death? I'm looking here at Stephen Clark's shooting death in 2018 in Sacramento, where he was struck in the back by police officers in his own backyard at least 8 times. His family was unhappy with the results of the police autopsy, ordered their own independent autopsy, and came to different conclusions about how Mr. Clark was killed. He was 22 years old. Would greater education and awareness have stopped something like that from happening?
Well, I can't go back in history and change facts and determine how something would have turned out, but I will say this. First and foremost, the coroner's office did not say he was shot 8 times in the back. I'm glad you used that example, because it's a tragedy.
Well, just to be clear, you're right. I'm so sorry, I just interrupt, but you're right. The coroner's office didn't say that. The family's independent autopsy said that he was struck in the back.
Correct.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you. But I think that's a good example to utilize, because most shootings that officers are involved in are split-second decisions. And so if that decision turns out to be wrong in the sense that it was a cell phone or a pellet gun or nothing that they perceived as a threat, well, the shooting's already happened. And so if we change a law, a word in a law, that shooting's still going to happen, because that person, that officer, thought their life was in danger, and so they responded. So how do we prevent a tragedy like that, that has been ruled within the law at every level of government, but it's still a horrific outcome? So how do we change that? So that's one of the reasons why we implemented a foot pursuit policy, because if that officer was never in the backyard, that wouldn't have happened. And so there's no one thing that's the solution, but that's why I say race and differences are at the root of everything that ails this country, and being one of the most powerful institutions in the country, it definitely impacts what we do and how people perceive us. For example, in 1808, they ruled that importing slaves was against the law in this country. Yet for the next 10, 20 years, 60,000 plus more slaves were imported. Well, why is it, if it's against the law, that that still happened? Because the country wasn't really against it. It was just a law on the books that nobody enforced and nobody did anything about. So we really have to address what ails us if we're going to get to this. That's the reason why, and I think I'm in complete agreement with the professor on the issue of training. Like, training is one of the ways, not the only way, and by itself it won't be the total solution, but training and providing experiences for not only members of our department but members of the community can start to counteract what is pounded into our heads every day. For example, when often people talk about the origination of law enforcement and slave patrols, well, they were enforcing somebody's law. Somebody created a law that made that person a slave and that they couldn't leave. Redlining was created by real estate associations and reinforced by the law. Sundown towns and blockbusting were all reinforced by, whether it's real estate agents or lawmakers. And law enforcement in the military has historically been used as the enforcement arm of something else. And so, and I mean, slave sales were advertised in the media. Klan meetings were advertised in the paper. So, I mean, there's not any institution or person in our country that can claim that, oh, well, I don't have any part of this. We all have to come together and say, this is our history. First and foremost, we need to know our history, and we do not. And so then we need to deal with how do we change our history. So that's why in this department, we are working with Dr. Eberhardt from Stanford University, Center for Policing Equity, Department of Justice just finished a review of, and all of those, we asked them to come in and review our department and make recommendations. Training has drastically changed since the time I went through the academy to now, with a lot of the things that I just told you about that have been implemented in the last couple of years. And although post mandates certain training, we probably do three times the amount of training that post mandates that all law enforcement agencies in California do. So I do agree that training and experiences is a large way of how we're going to counteract what ails us. But we have to consciously do that.
Chief Han, I'm so sorry to have to interrupt you, but we've just got a minute left to go, and I want to be able to give the professor a last word here. So Chief Daniel Han, Sacramento Police Chief, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Professor Sierra Arevalo, just a last thought from you. There's so much more that we could discuss, but I want to give you a chance to have a last word in about 40 seconds that we have.
So just to reframe what my point is, I actually am not convinced that training will save us. We have tried all kinds of things like implicit bias training, de-escalation training, crisis intervention training. The problems that I observed in the academy and on patrol are problems that are intentional and built into the very fabric of policing. This is part of the conversation now about reformulating what we even mean by public safety, defunding the police, reformulating and changing the role of police in society. And that, I think, is the real way forward.
Well, Michael Sierra Arevalo is a sociology professor at the University of Texas at Austin. We have a link to his paper on the danger imperative, and he's also got a forthcoming book. He's currently at work on that book. It's called Peril on Patrol. Professor Sierra Arevalo, thank you so very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.